This lecture, The Path to Sound Money, was delivered at the Ludwig von Mises Institute's Mises Summer University in August of 2007 in Auburn, Alabama. Well, good morning, everybody. The pressure of time makes it necessary that we start on schedule. I have an outline up on the screen. I need to be sure to move further down as I proceed. Well, my subject today is the path to sound money. It's not terribly difficult to explain what sound money is. It's a money that would be both inflation-proof and deflation-depression-proof. What best fits such a description is gold and also silver. And this brings us immediately to the 100% reserve gold standard as the ultimate ideal. Gold money is inflation-proof because of the inherent limits to the increase in its supply. Gold is rare in nature. A far smaller fraction of the Earth's mass is gold than is the case with almost all other chemical elements in general and metals in particular. To increase its supply, it must laboriously be dug out of the ground at a very high cost, as a rule. And these factors greatly limit the increase in the supply of gold, and thus any possible decline in its buying power. The same is true, though in somewhat lesser degree, of silver. Now, this is in sharpest contrast to paper money, whose supply can be increased without limit and at practically no cost whatever. Increasing the supply of paper money no longer even requires running sheets of paper through printing presses and adding as many zeros as one likes. The equivalent of more paper currency can be created simply by making ledger entries to checking accounts, and nowadays not even by hand, but by computer. The only thing that limits the supply of paper money is the discretionary choice of government officials not to increase the supply any more rapidly than they already do. Well, that's no real barrier at all. Now, not only is gold inflation-proof, but in its pure form of a 100% reserve gold standard, it's also deflation-depression-proof, and this requires explanation. Just as inflation is not rising prices, but a phenomenon of an increasing quantity of money and consequent rising volume of spending, so deflation is not falling prices, but a phenomenon of a decreasing quantity of money and consequent falling volume of spending. Falling prices caused by increased production in the face of an unchanged quantity of money and volume of spending do not reduce general business profitability and do not make the repayment of debt more difficult. Indeed, falling prices under a 100% reserve gold standard are the result of the increase in production outstripping an increase in gold money and in spending in terms of gold. It must be stressed that under a gold standard and the falling prices that normally accompany it, there is indeed some increase in the quantity of money. The increase, of course, is at a modest rate. In my lecture on money and banking, and in my session, The Economics of Inflation, I defined inflation, following Rothbard, as an increase in the quantity of money more rapid than the increase in the supply of gold. As I show in capitalism, this modest rate of increase in the quantity of gold money under a gold standard has the effect of correspondingly elevating the nominal rate of profit interest. It does so to the extent that the quantity of gold and spending denominated in gold increases from year to year. This elevation in the rate of profit interest occurs irrespective of any fall in prices caused by increases in production. Furthermore, this same cause, more gold money and thus more spending in terms of gold, operates to make the earning of any given sum of money somewhat easier rather than more difficult, and thus makes debt repayment somewhat easier rather than more difficult, again, irrespective of any fall in prices caused by increases in production. The falling prices associated with plunging profits and a greater difficulty of repaying debt, that is, associated with deflation and depression, are not the result of any increases in production and supply, but of a decrease in the quantity of money and volume of spending. It is this which reduces sales revenues and profits, as well as prices, along with making the earning of any given sum of money more difficult. And I can think of no worse contradiction than to call by the same name the result of increases in production, the foundation of prosperity, to call that by the same name we'd describe depression. That's tantamount to saying production is the cause of poverty. But under a 100% gold reserve standard, such financial contraction cannot occur. That is a phenomenon of fractional reserve banking, under which the failure of debtors causes a failure of the banks to which they owe money, and thus a wiping out of the money issued by those banks. This reduction in the quantity of money serves to reduce spending, sales revenues, and profits, and to cause still more business failures and bank failures, and so on and on, threatening the existence of all money constituted by fiduciary media. In contrast, under a 100% gold reserve standard, no failure of debtors anywhere can reduce the quantity of money. This is because once gold money comes into existence, it remains in existence. It is not wiped out by any decline in the value of any form of financial backing, such as borrowers' IOUs or bonds or stock certificates. It does not have any such backing. Gold provides its own backing in that it is valuable in its own right and does not depend for its value on such things as borrowers' IOUs, bonds, or stock certificates. Financial contraction is in part also the result of the fact that in its expansion phase, fractional reserve banking artificially reduces the demand for money for holding, which must later on return to its previous higher level. This too is the source of a plunge in spending and helps to explain what precipitates bankruptcies and bank failures. These considerations show that under a 100% gold reserve standard, financial contraction, i.e. deflation depression, is impossible. Once gold money comes into existence, it stays in existence. And because there are no fiduciary media, there is no money that can suddenly go out of existence, and no money whose creation serves artificially to reduce the demand for money for holding, and thereby set the stage for a later sudden substantial increase in the demand for money for holding. In sum, there is just gold money with its solid, modestly increasing supply and a demand for holding that is not subject to sudden major swings. Combine this with gold's inherent obstacles to rapid increases in its supply, and it should be clear that a 100% gold reserve standard is the ideal monetary system. It is both inflation-proof and deflation-depression-proof. I have to point out that a 100% gold reserve standard probably implies an important monetary role for silver. This is because the very high real value of gold, because of the very high real value of gold that would exist under it. And this can be seen even today with gold moving between $600 and $700 per ounce, which represents a far lower real value than it would have under a 100% reserve gold standard. A monetary role for silver follows from the very high real value of gold in conjunction with the requirement that every gold coin contain a quantity of gold great enough to be directly perceivable and easily handled by the average person. The smallest gold coin consistent with these requirements is probably approximated by the old U.S. gold $1 coin, which contained about 1/20th of an ounce of gold and was smaller in diameter than a dime. At a gold price of $600 per ounce, such a coin would today have a buying power of $30. At the far higher gold price that would be necessary to achieve a 100% reserve standard, it would have a value many times greater. This is simply too great a value for many of the cash retail transactions of day-to-day life, such as buying groceries or taking a taxi cab. It was for this reason that historically silver circulated alongside of gold, and why below silver it was even necessary to have a subsidiary copper coinage. Taking the 100% gold reserve standard as the ideal monetary system to be achieved, the question now arises of how actually to go about achieving it. And this brings us to proposals to reestablish gold as money, and we'll start with the Mises plan. Now, Mises sought to establish a lesser variant of the 100% reserve gold standard, namely a 100% reserve, a 100% marginal reserve gold standard, a 100% marginal reserve gold standard. The meaning of that will become clear, hopefully, in a few minutes. Mises presented his plan in the 1953 edition of The Theory of Money and Credit, in a specially appended Part 4 titled Monetary Reconstruction. When he presented his plan, the private ownership of gold for monetary purposes was a felony in the United States, subject to a penalty of $10,000 fine and a year in jail. And gold was officially pegged at $35 per ounce, where it had been since about 1935. Well, Mises's plan called for the establishment of a free gold market, which we now have and have had since 1975. It also called for freezing the existing supply of paper and checkbook money once a free gold market had been established. The next step would be to wait for the price of gold to stabilize and be on the verge of actually falling, something that would occur inevitably if the supply of paper money is rigidly fixed and the supply of gold is modestly increasing. That gold price, on the verge of which gold would be falling, that would be the new gold parity. The dollar would then be freely convertible into gold at that price. This means that the government would have to dip into its gold reserves and redeem, at the new gold parity, whatever dollar notes were presented to it. A government conversion agency would issue new and additional currency against a 100% reserve. This is a 100% marginal reserve. Banks, too, would hold a 100% marginal reserve against new deposits. What this means is that new and additional gold being brought to the government in exchange for new and additional paper notes, that new and additional gold would have to be retained by the government in full after it had issued those notes. Thus, for example, if someone brought to the government $100,000 worth of gold at the new parity, say, for the sake of illustration, $40 per ounce, to make the arithmetic simple, the government would have to keep in its vaults 2,500 ounces of gold, the 2,500 ounces of gold that this individual had brought in. Similarly, when an individual deposited gold into his checking account, the bank would have to keep the full amount of that gold as a reserve against his deposit. Already outstanding notes and deposits, however, would have only a fractional reserve. So it's only the new and additional deposits and notes that have a 100% reserve. It was essential in Mises's view that gold coins play a central role. No paper notes were to be permitted in key denominations. His plan called for a classical gold standard, a gold standard with actual circulating gold coins. Specifically, Mises advocated replacing the $5, $10, and possibly $20 notes with gold coins and prohibiting the further issue of any paper currency in those denominations. He wanted to eliminate all paper currency in those denominations. He believed that people needed firsthand experience of the use of gold as money in their daily lives, so that if and when the government ever again resorted to inflation, the result would be glaringly obvious in the form of a disappearance of the gold coins from circulation. He believed that this would alert the citizens to the nature of what was going on and that their ensuing outcry would stop the process. As I've stated, at the time Mises presented his plan, gold was pegged at $35 per ounce. Mises thought that it would go to $36 to $38 on a free gold market, and that that would be sufficient. It must also be noted that the U.S. money supply back in 1953 was something on the order of about $100 billion. And at the same time, the government had vastly larger gold reserves than it does now. Thus, the ratio of gold to the money supply was enormously greater at the time of his proposal than it is today. Well, today we have a more or less free gold market, but the great reduction in the Federal Reserve's gold reserves that has taken place since 1953, coupled with the enormous increase in the quantity of paper and checkbook money that has taken place since then, has resulted in today's gold reserves being insufficient to support the kind of gold standard Mises urged. Today, even at a gold price of $600 per ounce, which is roughly where it now is, the Federal Reserve's gold holding of little more than 250 million ounces, I rounded to 250, it's actually 260. These gold holdings, taking them at 250 million ounces at a price of 600, well, that amounts to $150 billion. That's just about 5% of the present outstanding money supply of approximately $3 trillion, and is not quite 19% of the currency and Federal Reserve deposit liabilities, which are roughly $800 billion. Today's U.S. government gold reserves are simply not great enough to replace very much of the paper currency, which now all by itself amounts to more than $750 billion. We need substantially more gold or a substantially higher gold parity than even $600 per ounce to have any kind of feasible gold standard as envisioned by Mises. Today, there's no possibility of replacing notes of $5, $10, and even $20 denomination with coins in which the gold would be directly perceivable and easily handled. At today's price of gold of $600 per ounce, gold coins in those denominations would have to range downward in size from 1/30th of an ounce of gold, in the case of $20 gold coins, to 1/120th of an ounce in the case of $5 gold coins. All of them would be substantially smaller than the very small $1 coin, which was the 1/20th of an ounce of gold that I referred to earlier. At higher gold prices, the problem becomes even more severe. With a $600 per ounce price of gold, it would be possible to have gold coins of $50 and $100 denomination. As indicated, however, the problem here is that we no longer have sufficient gold to replace all of these notes. There are probably more than 400 billion of these notes, 50s and 100s, in circulation around the world, while today's U.S. gold reserves are only on the order of 150 billion. So it's presently not possible to follow Mises' plan with respect to retiring all of those notes, even in those denominations. Okay, well, I turn now to Rothbard's plan, which is an attempt to establish a full-bodied 100% reserve gold standard. In contrast to Mises, it is a full-bodied 100% reserve gold standard. Rothbard presented his plan in the Case for a 100% Gold Dollar, which was published in 1962. I think you all had to read it prior to coming here, if I'm not mistaken. Before that, he presented his plan sometime in the mid-1950s in a monograph that circulated under very tight security at the Foundation for Economic Education, where it was treated as something of a hot potato, with each copy having a unique identifying number. I'd be surprised if there was not one or more copies of it somewhere here in the Institute's archives. My own ideas on the subject are greatly influenced by that monograph. Well, in the Case for a 100% Gold Dollar, Rothbard urges the following essential steps, and I'll quote him here. One, arrival of a 100% gold dollar, either by deflation of dollars to a gold stock valued at $35 per ounce, or by revaluation of the dollar at a gold price high enough to make the gold stock 100% of the present supply of dollars, or a blend of the two routes. Two, getting the gold stock out of the hands of the government and into the hands of the banks and the people, with a concomitant liquidation of the Federal Reserve System and a legal 100% requirement for all demand claims. 3. The transfer of all note issue functions from the Treasury and the Federal Reserve to the private banks. All banks, in short, would be allowed to issue deposits or notes at the discretion of their clients. I'll skip 4, it's not immediately relevant to us. 5, the eventual elimination of the term dollar, using only terms of weight such as gold gram or gold ounce. The ultimate goal would be the return to gold by every nation at 100% of its particular currency, and the subsequent blending of all these national currencies into one unified world gold gram unit, end quote. Well, Rothbard's plan, I think, is brilliant in its simplicity. It's a clear, definite way to achieve a 100% gold standard, a 100% reserve gold standard. And as I say, I myself have adopted most of its essential features in the portion of capitalism where I argue for the establishment of a 100% reserve gold standard. Unfortunately, his plan is not without some potentially very serious problems. And Rothbard takes note of these difficulties only in a very few words when he writes, quote, "There is no question about the difficulty of the transition period required to reach our goal. But once the transition period is concluded, we will have the satisfaction of possessing the best monetary system known to man and of eliminating inflation, business cycles, and the uneconomic and immoral practice of people acquiring money at the expense of producers." This is near the very end of his pamphlet. A page later, he adds, "But certainly a matter for genuine concern would be the enormous impetus such a change would give for several years to the mining of gold, as well as the disruption it would cause in the pattern of international trade," end quote. All right, well, I want to delve into what I consider the problems with Rothbard's plan as originally presented. And then I'll attempt to see how those problems might possibly be overcome. All right, at this point, I want to explain in some detail what the difficulties are. I'll begin with the possibility of resort to deflation of the stock of money denominated in dollars as the means of establishing the 100% reserve gold standard. In the passages I quoted a moment or two ago, Rothbard actually held out the possibility of, quote, arrival of a 100% gold dollar by deflation of dollars to a gold stock valued at $35 per ounce, end quote. If that possibility were pursued today, it would entail a deflation of the money supply from roughly $3 trillion, which is what it now is, all the way down to less than $9 billion, which is what the dollar value of 250 million ounces of gold would be at $35 per ounce. This would be a deflation of greater than 99%. But even if we take the current price of gold of roughly $600 to $700 per ounce, the magnitude of deflation would still be 94 to 95%. This follows from the fact that at 600 per ounce, the government's approximately 250 million ounces is only worth $150 billion, which is a mere 5% of the overall money supply of $3 trillion. So to deflate from $3 trillion to $150 billion, that's a 95% reduction. Well, this would be a deflation far, far in excess of the record deflation of 1929 to 1933, which was on the order of 25% of the money supply, and at that level wreaked havoc. The decline in money revenues and incomes that resulted at that time was on the order of 45%, the combined result of the 25% reduction in the quantity of money and an ensuing major rise in the demand for money for holding. In the course of that decline, wave after wave of bankruptcies occurred as it became impossible for people both to honor their financial obligations and to meet the operating expenses of their businesses or the expenses of daily life. If one of the main reasons for advocating a 100% reserve gold standard is to avoid depressions, It does not seem reasonable to try to establish that standard by means of what would be a far greater depression than what has up to now been the world's greatest depression. I think it's obvious that the deflationary aspect of Rothbard's plan needs to be rejected, at least as far as serving as a major means of equalizing the quantity of dollars with the government's gold reserves. Let me turn now to the other half of Rothbard's proposed means of equalizing the quantity of dollars with the government's gold reserves, namely a revaluation of the dollar at a gold price high enough to make the gold stock 100% of the present supply of dollars. At the present time, with a money supply of $3 trillion and gold reserves on the order of 250 billion million ounces, the price of gold required to make those 250 million ounces equal to $3 trillion would be $12,000 an ounce. Indeed, on the basis of the way that Rothbard and many other Austrians calculate the money supply, the equalization price would be more than twice that number. This is because they use a measure of the money supply known as M2, which includes passbook savings accounts and certificates of deposit of less than $100,000. My measurement of the money supply, in contrast, excludes these items. It is limited to funds, my measure, that are not only payable on demand, but which are also directly transferable to others in exchange for goods or services. Such transferability does not apply to passbook savings accounts or certificates of deposit. These must first be redeemed for money before they can be spent. However one calculates the quantity of U.S. dollars, a major consideration that must be dealt with is that the U.S. government's gold supply is by no means the total amount of gold that might circulate in the American economic system. Central banks other than the Federal Reserve also hold gold. The amount of their holdings is estimated to be on the order of 700 million ounces. Beyond that, most of the world's gold is held outside of central banks altogether. In fact, some estimates place the amount of gold held outside central banks at more than four times as great as the gold held in central banks. On this basis, one might estimate the total world gold supply of above-ground gold at approximately 4 billion ounces. The World Gold Council estimates the total amount of gold that has ever been mined at somewhat more than 4.6 billion ounces. The existence of this outside gold, so to speak, outside the hands of the Federal Reserve, is fortunate indeed. This is because some of it would be required to counteract what would otherwise be an impetus to major financial contraction, even in the absence of any decrease in the money supply in terms of dollars. This is because, apart from any possible reduction in the quantity of money, the establishment of a 100% reserve gold standard must bring about a substantial increase in the demand for money for holding, and thus a corresponding reduction in the so-called velocity of circulation of money. Thus, transitioning to a 100% reserve gold standard, even with an unchanged quantity of dollars, let alone a reduced quantity, would be accompanied by a substantial decline in total spending and in money sales revenues and income payments in terms of dollars. The underlying reason for the rise in demand for money for holding is that gold is something that it is far more desirable to own and hold than is paper money. It not only retains its value infinitely better, but under the conditions of a 100% reserve gold standard, there would be no credit expansion and thus no inducement to run cash holdings down in the expectation of being able easily and profitably to replace them by means of borrowing. Nor would there be the artificial inducement provided by rapid rates of increase in paper money to hold inventories in place of cash, in the expectation of being able easily and profitably to liquidate them in the face of rapidly rising spending. Finally, a lower nominal rate of profit and interest, reflecting a lower rate of increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending, would operate to take away the profitability of lending out sums of money of relatively small size for relatively short periods of time, such funds would remain in cash holdings. These considerations imply that the transition to a 100% reserve gold standard must be accompanied by a more or less substantial increase in the supply of dollars represented by the supply of gold. If a major fall in total spending in terms of dollars is to be avoided, this increase is available in the form of outside gold, that is, gold entering the economic system from other than the Federal Reserve system. Ideally, the availability of the right amount of such gold would make it possible for the adoption of a 100% reserve gold standard to result both in the immediate end of inflation and the avoidance of any subsequent major financial contraction resulting from the ensuing increase in the demand for money for holding. Inflation would stop because the increase in the supply of money would now be determined by the much more modest rate of increase in the supply of gold compared with paper money. At the same time, the ensuing rise in the demand for money for holding would be offset by the outside gold entering the American economic system. This gold would increase the supply of money in terms of dollars to the extent needed to offset the fall in the so-called velocity of circulation of money. To illustrate this, this is purely for illustration, imagine an economic system similar to our own with a paper money supply of $3 trillion and a gold stock of 250 million ounces. For the sake of simplicity, we assume that its velocity of money is 4. This would imply that it has a GDP of $12 trillion. 4, the velocity, times $3 trillion, the money supply. Now imagine that following the adoption of a 100% reserve gold standard at a gold price of $12,000 per ounce, the velocity of money in the system falls from 4 all the way to 2. Nevertheless, no reduction in aggregate spending in terms of dollars would take place in the economic system if the quantity of gold present in it rose from 250 million ounces to 500 million ounces. Such a supply of gold at $12,000 per ounce would represent a money supply of $6 trillion in terms of dollars. With a velocity of 2, this doubled money supply in dollars would result in the same dollar GDP of $12 trillion as before. Unfortunately, the problem is the possibility of so much outside gold entering the economic system as to far surpass the amount needed to offset the increase in the demand for money for holding, and thus cause a major inflation in terms of the supply of dollars and the amount of spending in terms of dollars. The American economy accounts for roughly 25% of the world's economy. Accordingly, one might expect it to have approximately 25% of the world's 4 billion ounces of gold, which would mean 1 billion ounces of gold. Virtually all of this gold could be available for monetary purposes, inasmuch as the sharply higher real value of gold as money would serve to increase the portion of the world's gold used as money at the expense of the portions held as jewelry or used in industrial employments. In that case, the U.S. supply of gold money would amount to approximately 1 billion ounces. Indeed, unless other major countries quickly followed suit in adopting the 100% reserve gold standard, or something close to it, the extremely high $12,000 an ounce value of gold in the United States might draw even more gold to its shores than a fourth of the world's supply. As I say, this implies a potential problem of major inflation in the U.S. as part of the transition. This is because while 250 million ounces of gold at 12,000 per ounce equals the present U.S. money supply of $3 trillion, a gold stock of a billion ounces at 12,000 per ounce would equal a money supply of $12 trillion, four times as large. A U.S. gold stock equal to half the world supply, or 2 billion ounces, might imply a U.S. money supply of $24 trillion. On top of this, there would be an unprecedented boom in gold mining that might last for decades, and which would substantially increase the world supply of gold, and thus the amount of gold that circulated in the U.S. The clear implication is that the transition to a 100% reserve gold standard, achieved simply by means of radically increasing the price of gold, holds major short-term inflationary potential. This potential exists primarily in the form of a vast increase in the money supply in terms of dollars based on the entry into the U.S., into the American economic system, of massive quantities of gold from sources other than the Federal Reserve System. It would then be compounded by a substantially more rapid rate of increase in the world's total gold supply for many years. Beyond this, to the extent that the U.S. initially attracted a disproportionate share of the world's gold, there would be a potential problem of a subsequent deflationary loss of gold when and if other countries adopted the 100% reserve gold standard or otherwise substantially increased the monetary role of gold in their economies. Imagine, for example, the effects of the U.S. first acquiring half the world's gold when it alone was on the 100% reserve gold standard, and then losing back half or more of that gold when and if the rest of the world adopted the 100% reserve gold standard. Two further problems must be mentioned in connection with transitioning to a 100% reserve gold standard by means of radically increasing the price of gold. One is the enormous increase in exports that would be required to pay for the importation of the vast additional quantities of gold. This, I'm sure, is what Rothbard had in mind when he referred to the disruption in the pattern of international trade. Such exports would represent the exchange of massive amounts of actual goods and services for the sake of accumulating an additional stock of money. This state of affairs might bring joy to the hearts of the legions of neo-mercantilists who would describe it as a highly favorable balance of trade, but from the point of view of the economic well-being of the average American, it would represent considerable deprivation in terms of the goods and services he might otherwise consume. The second further problem is that of a windfall gain in assets by the banking system. Rothbard's plan entails putting the banking system on a 100% reserve basis by means of transferring to the banks sufficient millions of ounces of gold valued at a price high enough to make those ounces equal the outstanding uncovered deposits. The gold so valued on the bank's books would stand alongside of and be in addition to the assets the banks possess that presently stand behind their deposits, such as treasury securities, commercial paper, mortgages, and so on. Indeed, to provide 100% backing for today's 2.2 trillion of fiduciary media, the government under Rothbard's plan would turn over to the banks gold valued at 2.2 trillion. This would be 2.2 trillion of new and additional assets beyond what the banks already have. This increase of 2.2 trillion on the asset side of the bank's balance sheets implies an equal increase on the liability side of their balance sheets. And there, the specific accounts that would be increased would be the bank's capital and surplus accounts. In other words, there would be an enormous windfall gain to the banks. I want to turn to addressing these various problems that I've presented. What would greatly mitigate both the potential short-run problem of an inflationary increase in the supply of gold in the U.S., followed by a subsequent deflationary loss of much of that gold, would be if the adoption of the 100% gold reserve standard could take place on an international basis in conjunction with the European Union and Japan and other major countries. In that case, the gold required to provide 100% reserves abroad would not be available for export to the United States in the first place, and thus would not later on have to be withdrawn from the United States. Such international cooperation, of course, would entail further problems. However, I'll make no effort to attempt to deal with those problems here. Failing such international cooperation, what would mitigate the problem of a short-run surge in the supply of gold, followed by a later loss of much of the additional gold, is widespread public understanding of the situation. To the extent that people realize that a large portion of the additional gold coming into their possession was only a temporary phenomenon, and thus used much or most of it merely to build up their gold cash holdings, that gold and the dollars it represented would not operate in an inflationary way. This is because it would simply be held rather than spent. And to the extent that people had not geared their normal financial operations to the presence of much or most of that additional gold, they would not later on suffer major deflationary effects by virtue of its subsequent outflow. In fact, they might even substantially benefit in the long run by their country having been the first to adopt the 100% reserve standard. This is because they would acquire gold at a relatively low value when it was only their country that established the standard, and then re-exchange it with the rest of the world at a higher value when other countries also established a 100% reserve gold standard. As for the loss imposed by exporting vast amounts of actual goods and services in exchange for the accumulation of a stock of gold money, it would be substantially less in the long run than is the loss regularly imposed by the system of fiat money. As I argued in Capitalism, under the fiat money system, every year the great majority of individual citizens, in effect, import fiat money in exchange for goods or services. For the great majority of citizens finish the year with a larger holding of fiat money than they began the year, and have had to trade away goods and services to do it. This is the withdrawal of wealth effect. It is the necessary outcome of increases in the quantity of money, which always end up in the cash holdings of the citizens. But unlike gold, whose supply normally increases only modestly from year to year, with fiat money, there is neither a limit nor an end to the process, short of the destruction of the fiat money in a currency collapse. As I've just shown, if American citizens imported excess gold, not only would there be a complete end to that process, but they could probably count on later exporting the gold at a higher value. Thus, their loss on this account would not be permanent, but even could be an actual gain. All right, the problem of the windfall gain to the banks. This problem could be avoided. One way to do so would be to give the benefit of a more or less substantial part of the 2.2 trillion increase in the bank's assets to the bank's depositors. This could be done by means of the issuance of bank securities in one form or another to the depositors. And the value of those securities would largely offset the gain in the value of the bank's assets. Alternatively, or in combination, the government could use the gold it turns over to the banks in order to put them on a 100% reserve basis as the purchase price of the bank's assets that presently back their fiduciary media. The government would then proceed to auction off those assets and use the proceeds to retire some portion of the national debt. The $800 billion of the government's gold that remains after providing for the elimination of $2.2 trillion of fiduciary media would be used to redeem the paper currency, which I've said amounts to roughly $750 billion. For the rest, it would be turned over to the banks that are members of the Federal Reserve System and to the other holders of deposits with the Federal Reserve System in exchange for the cancellation of their deposits. In accordance with Rothbard's plan, following the physical transfer of all of its gold to the various private parties involved, the Federal Reserve System would simply go out of existence. It would have no further role to play. It would turn over its government securities to the U.S. Treasury, and its remaining assets would be auctioned off. Now, as I've shown, the path to the establishment of a 100% gold reserve will not be a smooth or easy one, but neither is avoiding that path, which is the only alternative to fiat money and fiduciary media. Fiat money and fiduciary media subject everyone to the continued loss of purchasing power and accompanying financial insecurity. They discourage saving, tax capital, and are responsible for malinvestment. They set the stage for deflation, depression, and mass unemployment. They promote the continuous expansion of government, foment hostility to profits and interest, create support for price controls and socialism, and ultimately threaten the very existence of a division of labor society. The bumps and ruts in the road to a 100% reserve gold standard are worth suffering as the price of eliminating fiat money and fiduciary media. Nevertheless, a 100% reserve gold standard is certainly not something that is going to be established anytime soon, to say the least. Fortunately, there are other smaller and less dramatic steps that might be taken in the direction of sound money. And I'll proceed to go through these. Creditors Protection Bill. One that I consider to be particularly important is enactment of a Creditors Protection Bill. This would be a law requiring that some modest percentage of the value of long-term contracts be payable at the creditor's option in gold, at the price of gold prevailing on the date of the contract's execution, instead of in paper money. In the face of major inflation, this might guarantee creditors recovering at least some significant portion of the real value due them instead of being wiped out. For example, a 5% requirement on a $1 million contract would entitle the creditor to the amount of gold, $50,000, that's 5% of the million, would buy when the contract was executed. In that case, if before the $1 million was payable, prices had risen 100-fold, but gold had risen 1,000-fold, creditors would be able to collect half in real terms of what was due them, instead of only 1% of what was due them. Just think, if prices rise 100-fold, you get repaid $1 million, but it buys only 1% of what $1 million used to buy. If you have the option of getting repaid $50,000 in gold, calculated at 500 an ounce or whatever, well, you at least get 100 ounces of gold. If it's risen 1,000-fold, then you get at least half of the real value of what you lent. Unimpeded inflation hedge demand. Another very important step in the direction of sound money would be the unimpeded operation of the demand for gold as an inflation hedge. The growth in such demand, which of course inflation itself encourages, is capable of leading to a sufficient proportion of the population wanting gold holdings as to create the basis for gold's reemergence as a medium of exchange. The way it would work is as follows. Today, if an individual who owns gold wants to buy something, he must first sell his gold for dollars and then use the dollars to buy what he wants. But if the desire to own gold as an inflation hedge were so widespread that the seller of what this individual wanted to buy himself wanted to own more gold, it would be possible to skip the steps of selling gold for dollars and then using the dollars to buy gold. The individual with gold could use it directly to buy from another individual who wanted to acquire gold. As such situations became more frequent, people would realize that it was possible to use gold as a medium of exchange. Soon, people who themselves did not wish to add gold to their savings would become willing to accept it in exchange in the knowledge that they could use it to re-exchange with others. This would represent an increase in the number of people willing to accept gold in exchange for their goods or services and make it even more suitable for use as a medium of exchange. The ultimate stopping point would be a universal willingness to accept gold in exchange, and thus the reemergence of gold as money. Indeed, it is always by means of a process such as this that a good becomes established as money, as Menger explained. Tax exemption. To facilitate the ownership of gold and its use as an inflation hedge, there should be no restrictions or discouragements to the buying and selling of gold, such as government record keeping or the collection of any sales or excise tax. Gains on the ownership of gold based on its on any rise in its price should be exempt from the income and capital gains taxes. Enforceability of gold contracts. Contracts made in terms of gold should be enforceable in the courts and never be construed as being in violation of the usury laws. If, for example, A lends B 100 ounces of gold today in exchange for the repayment of 105 ounces a year later, no intervening rise in the price of gold should be allowed to be the basis of any court declaring the contract to have entailed the payment of more than the 5% interest rate that is payable in gold. Even if, in the interval, the price of gold doubles and the number of dollars that must be repaid consequently stands in a ratio of 2.1 to 1 rather than 1.05 to 1, the gold interest rate of 5% must be held to prevail. Um, in such favorable conditions, more and more contracts would come to be written in terms of gold. The growth in contracts payable in gold would serve to remonetize gold, because those with obligations payable in gold would want to sell their goods and services for gold in order to be able to meet their financial obligations payable in gold. Legal discrimination between gold and paper. The process of gold spontaneously coming to be used as money would be greatly promoted if merchants were legally free to discriminate between precious metal coins and paper money of the same face value. As I explained in my first lecture on Monday, what this means, for example, is that they should be able to treat a $20 gold coin, which contains approximately an ounce of gold, as the equivalent of as many paper dollars as are currently required to buy an ounce of gold. As of this morning, that was 670-something dollars. This would greatly promote both public understanding of inflation as residing in the paper money and lead to the large-scale writing of contracts in gold, such as pensions, leases, and bonds. For people would then see on a daily basis that the rise in prices was in the paper money. That is what such experiences as the same goods costing $20 in gold and $600 or $700 in paper would teach. Now, inasmuch as we've seen those who have debts to pay in gold are eager to sell for gold, there is a strong implication here that under free competition between gold and paper, the market will choose gold as money. Allowing gold to be accepted in exchange at its actual market value, rather than merely at its face value, would make the superiority of gold to paper manifest to practically everyone. As more and more contracts came to be written in gold, more and more individuals and business firms came to have financial obligations payable in gold, and thus became eager to sell for gold. There would be less and less need for paper. An accelerating drop in the demand for it would be added to the rapid increase in its supply and send its value to zero and to the sewers, The only thing that would keep paper money in existence under free competition with gold would be its being made securely convertible to gold on demand, i.e. a gold standard of some kind. Now I have a point here, importance of a higher price of gold. The growth in gold contracts would be greatly accelerated if the real value of gold relative to paper money could reach its peak before vast sums of gold came to be payable, before vast debts came to be payable in gold. We'd like the real value of gold to get up there before we have massive debts payable in gold. What this would accomplish is removal of a major financial danger in obligating oneself to pay gold in the future. This is the nature of the danger. If, for example, one were to borrow 100 ounces of gold today, when its price is in the 600 per ounce range, and agree to repay that gold plus interest in gold in 10 years, the repayment might prove extraordinarily difficult or impossible, depending on the extent to which the real value of gold rose over the next 10 years. If one's paper money income doubled over the next 10 years, but the price of gold quadrupled, that would mean that it took twice the portion of one's income to repay the gold debt. If one's paper money income rose by a factor of 10, while the price of gold rose by a factor of 100, it would take a portion of one's income 10 times as large to repay the same gold debt. And if that portion were already more than 10% of one's income, indeed, if it were anything within a few percentage points less than 10%, one simply could not pay the gold debt. To avoid such situations, what is needed is gold already so high relative to paper that further relative appreciation will be inconsequential. An important economic principle that is very relevant here is that to the extent that the rise in the price of gold outstrips the rate of increase in the quantity of paper money, the supply of paper money actually shrinks in terms of its ability to pay debts denominated in gold. In other words, the inflation of paper becomes simultaneously deflationary from the perspective of gold. For example, today, the quantity of paper money is $3 trillion, and the price of gold is about $600. What this means is that at present, $3 trillion can serve as the equivalent of 5 billion ounces of gold, each at $600 per ounce. in sustaining the income payments and other spending required to provide the funds with which to pay debts in gold. Now imagine that in 10 years, the quantity of paper money has doubled to $6 trillion, but the price of gold has quadrupled to 2,400 per ounce. In these circumstances, the doubled supply of paper money would be equivalent to only half as much gold, i.e., 2.5 billion ounces of gold. Just divide 6 trillion by 2,400, compare it with 3 trillion divided by 600, the supply of paper is equivalent to half the gold that it used to be. Now, I made a brief application yesterday on the panel to this helping possibly to explain conditions in 1929. Lack of time prevents me from expanding on that here. I'll jump ahead. Government policy to raise the price of gold. And this would be in order to avoid the deflationary effects of the expansion of paper in terms of the ability to repay gold. There are some legitimate steps the government could take to help bring this about, to help elevate the real value of gold before the massive debts became payable. One would be to auction off for gold as much of its present property as possible, or use the proceeds obtained from such auctions in terms of paper money to buy gold. The sale of the federal government's vast land holdings in the western states and in Alaska should be high on the list, along with Amtrak, the U.S. Post Office, public housing, and the Tennessee Valley Authority. In addition, the government could make the tariff and the various federal excise taxes payable in gold or with notes or checking deposits 100% backed by gold. These measures could be phased in over a period of years. The result of the auction sales for gold or the collection of some tax revenues in gold would be both a sharply higher price of gold and larger gold reserves. If the government's gold reserves grew sufficiently, some version of Mises' plan for reestablishing gold as money might be adopted, not as an ultimate solution, but as a major step forward. Finally, both to raise the price of gold and to aid in the growth of private gold ownership, the government should allow private minters of new gold and also silver coins to use the seal of the United States for some years. This would help to promote the acceptability of these coins. Well, I know that the various measures I've proposed may seem such a long way off as to be perhaps not even worth considering, but that is not true. Less than 20 years ago, the prospect of the Soviet Union and its satellite empire disappearing seemed no less remote, but then it happened. Similarly, but on the other side of the spectrum, 20 years ago, the demands of the environmental movement were widely and rightly dismissed as lunacy. Today, people are racing to accept the lunacy. The point is that we should not worry about what is popular or unpopular at the moment, but simply focus on what we believe is right or wrong, and proceed on the assumption that when we know what is right and how to achieve it and can argue logically and clearly in its favor, the necessary popularity will follow. Along these lines, I think it's appropriate that I close with this quotation from Rothbard's The Case for 100% Gold Dollar. Quote, "There is no gainsaying the fact that this suggested program will strike most people as impossibly radical and unrealistic. Any suggestion for changing the status quo, no matter how slight, can always be considered by someone as too radical, so that the only thoroughgoing escape from the charge of impracticality is never to advocate any change whatever in existing conditions. But to take this approach is to abandon human reason and to drift in animal or plant-like manner with the tide of events. As Professor Philbrook pointed out in a brilliant article some years ago, we must frame our policy convictions on what we believe the best course to be and then try to convince others of this goal, and not include within our policy conclusions estimates of what other people may find acceptable. For someone must propagate the truth in society as opposed to what is politically expedient. If scholars and intellectuals fail to do so, if they fail to expand their convictions of what they believe the correct course to be, they are abandoning truth and therefore abandoning their very raison d'etre. All hope of social progress would then be gone, for no new ideas would ever be advanced, nor effort expended to convince others of their validity, end quote. Well, thank you very much for coming and hearing me today. Well, I guess we have 10 nanoseconds for questions. Yes, Professor Garrison.
Your thing is, the money's by pretty
quick. Right, where did I get?
Double M1, but not part of M2. So if you start with M2 and subtract out
TV. Well, actually, I started, Professor Garrison's question is, how did I come up with $3 trillion as my estimate of the money supply? I began with a measure called M1, which is a currency and normal traditional type checking deposits. Then I added to that a measure of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis for sweep accounts, which is money that would normally appear under M1, but in the last 10 years or so has more and more been swept into time deposits over weekends and holidays in order to reduce reserve requirements. So I added sweep accounts to M1, and then I added money market retail mutual funds. And that comes out to about $3 trillion. And I know that that's arguable, and I myself am not fully convinced that the money market mutual funds are really, to their full extent, the equivalent of M1. You can write checks with them. I don't include the institutional money funds, which you might add, but I think they're largely or almost entirely confined to financial transactions in the stock market. People are not buying ordinary goods, as far as I know, with the institutional money funds. You do get checks for ordinary goods sometimes on retail money funds. So it's not a perfect estimate. Yes?
To deal with international problems concerning going back to the gold standard and it being deflationary and all the price adjustments.
Yeah.
Would you recommend, I mean, this may be utilitarian, but another Bretton Woods Accords per se?
Well, certainly nothing like Bretton Woods, but you see, you're raising an issue which I haven't given sufficient thought to. I say it would be desirable to have international cooperation, but when you get into what would that mean in detail, there would have to be, I would imagine, some substantial transfer of gold reserves among the different countries. And just how you would work that out, I can't tell you, certainly not at this point. I think an overriding consideration is we'd like to get to a sound money structure, but we don't want to do it in a way that is a solution that's practically as bad or maybe even worse than what we're attempting to combat. So we don't want a situation where masses of people are wiped out either through deflation or inflation. We really need to avoid that. Yes, sir.
Assuming you're not having major disasters of some sort, is there anything else that causes inflation except for the expansion of the money supply?
I would say absolutely nothing. Declines in physical production are capable of raising the overall average of prices, but as I explained yesterday, they don't produce the debtor-creditor effects that we associate with inflation. They don't raise the broad range of prices that we associate. And you could never have even a substantial prolonged rise in the weighted average of prices. Just think of the implications of prices rising 5% per year. On the basis of less supply, the economy would have to be physically halving every 14 years. Well, I guess we've come to our end. I thank you again.